Our scripture passage, our sermon passage this morning is found in the book of James, towards the end of the New Testament. And we're going to be reading from James 1, verses 5 through 8. So turn there with me. James 1, 5 through 8. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. But let him ask in faith, with no doubting, for the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind. For that person must not suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. He is a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways.
Thanks, Courtney. Well, we are continuing our sermon series in the book of James together this morning. And as we do, it's really important to keep in mind what we've seen so far in this book as we come here to verses 5 through 8. And so as John mentioned a couple weeks ago, James has a writing style that is more like Proverbs than like Paul. So sometimes it can be a little hard to follow James' flow of thought here. And so if we're not careful, we can come to a section like verses 5 to 8 here, like Courtney just read, and disconnect these verses from what came before and what comes after, because it sounds like James is talking about something completely different here, like he's switching topics. But James hasn't actually changed topics at all. He's not moving on from what he just said in verses 2 to 4. He's building on it. And so if we're going to track with and understand what James is saying here in verses 5 to 8, it's really important to keep in mind what we've seen so far the last couple of weeks and how it leads up to the question that James is going to answer next. And so if you remember, 2 weeks ago, John introduced the book of James by walking us through verse 1 and setting up the context and purpose of this book. And so he talked about how this book was written by James, the half-brother of Jesus, who ended up becoming the key leader in the church of Jerusalem. And he's writing then to Jewish Christians who had been part of the church in Jerusalem, but who had scattered out from Jerusalem because of persecution, likely the persecution that came after the stoning of Stephen in Acts chapter 7 and 8. But they found that getting away from Jerusalem didn't mean getting away from suffering and opposition. In the cultural context that these believers lived, following Jesus put them at odds with the world around them. And so as they tried to flee the persecution in Jerusalem and establish their lives in other places, they found themselves poor and suffering and being oppressed and exploited by the rich unbelievers around them. And so James then is writing to these suffering believers really as their pastor, to give them counsel and instruction for how to live like who they are as followers of Jesus in the midst of suffering and opposition and persecution that they continue to face. And so John talked about a couple weeks ago a few different reasons then that James wrote this letter, but really they're all connected by one primary purpose of encouraging his readers to remain steadfast in the middle of suffering. That key word that we talked about that bookends this whole letter, to remain steadfast, to patiently endure and continue trusting the Lord in the middle of trials and suffering, and then really fleshing out what that looks like in everyday life. That's the purpose of the book of James. And so it's no surprise then that that's exactly what James begins the letter with, which is what Jonathan then walked us through in verses 2 to 4 last week, which if you remember, James begins the body of his letter then by calling these believers to count it all joy when they meet trials of various kinds, because they know that the testing of their faith produces steadfastness. And he calls them to let that steadfastness then have its full effect so that they would be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. And so the point that Jonathan walked us through last week is that James is giving these believers a big picture view of the various sufferings that they're experiencing. Like, he wants them to see how, as painful and confusing as it may be in the moment, their suffering is actually producing something good in them. Like, God is refining them through their suffering. He's maturing their faith and sanctifying them. He's making them more and more like Jesus. And so the point is that knowing that this is what suffering is producing in us should transform then the way that we respond to suffering. And so specifically, James tells us to count it all joy. Like, if this is what trials and suffering are producing in us, rather than fearing suffering or groaning and complaining under suffering, instead we should rejoice because this is producing steadfastness in us. It's strengthening our faith and maturing us spiritually in ways that nothing else can. And so then he tells us to let that steadfastness have its full effect. Like, if this is what trials and sufferings are producing in us, rather than gritting our teeth and having our focus being on just getting this over with and getting away from this trial as quickly as possible, instead it causes us to patiently endure and say, Lord, let this have its full effect in me. Like, use this to produce in me what is ultimately good for me. Which all sounds great, right? Like, I love James 1, 2 through 4. Like, the Lord has used those verses in so many ways in my own life over the past few years in particular, and they're verses that I've pointed others to more times than I can count, even recently. But the reality is this, like, and we know this. It's one thing to say and even genuinely believe all of that when you're not currently suffering. It's a whole other thing to continue to say that and to continue to believe that when you're in the middle of suffering. It's one thing to encourage each other with that truth when we're in between seasons of suffering. But, like, how are you going to respond if someone comes at you with this when the pain is deep and the suffering doesn't feel like it's going to end? Count it all joy. Let it have its full effect. I mean, that's still 100% true. And we know it. And we know that the person saying those things to us loves us and is trying to help. But in the middle of suffering, like, those words can easily have the opposite effect, right? Like, they can almost deepen our sense of suffering. Or we can misunderstand what James is saying even in those moments and think that we're just supposed to hide our pain and hide our tears and put on a fake smile and pretend like everything's good so that we look like we're doing what James says to do here. And again, this isn't theoretical for James' audience. Like, this is their present reality. And I know for many of us in this room, this isn't theoretical either. Like, so many of us are walking through deep hurt and deep pain and deep suffering right now, whether that's physical pain or grieving the loss of loved ones or hurting because of damaged or broken relationships or opposition at school or work or financial struggles or suffering from depression, anxiety, or just to name a few. And even if that's not you right now, we've all been there before, and eventually we'll all be there again. And so the question verses 2 through 4 leave us with is, how in the world do you do this? How do you actually do this? Like, how do you respond to suffering and trials with genuine joy and real steadfastness? That's the question then that verses 5 to 8 are going to answer for us here this morning. Like, it may look at first like James completely changes topics here in these verses, but we're going to see that that's not the case at all. Instead, what we're going to see is that, in a sense, verses 2 through 4 were the what and the why. Count it all joy and let steadfastness have its full effect because of what trials and suffering will ultimately produce in you. The what and the why. Verses 5 to 8 then are the how. And that's the main heading you can see there on your handout. That's what we're going to see in our passage here this morning, how to respond to trials with joy and steadfastness. And as we walk through these verses, then we're going to see basically a three-part answer to that question. So there is a logical progression to this, but they're not really steps as if you just check off each of these boxes in order and then you'll be ready to respond to trials with joy and steadfastness. It's far more simultaneous and ongoing than that. In order to respond to trials and suffering with joy and steadfastness, like this is the heart posture that must characterize us and the process that we must continually be going through. And so my hope and prayer is that this passage would give us the practical help that we need to do what we saw in verses 2-4 last week. That this passage would help us become more and more individuals and a church that actually respond to trials with joy and steadfastness. And so look with me then at James chapter 1, verses 5-8 here, and let's learn from James how to respond to trials with joy and steadfastness. So the first part of the answer, James understates a little bit here in the first part of verse 5, but it's this. You can see this on your handout. To respond to trials with joy and steadfastness, first you need to recognize your need for wisdom. Recognize your need for wisdom. And so look how James begins verse 5. He says, if any of you lacks wisdom. And so just six little words in English. But there is so much more going on in this phrase than is immediately obvious. First, in the original, in the Greek, there's actually another word here that the ESV chooses to leave untranslated for some reason. If you happen to have a CSB, Christian Standard Bible, you'll notice that this phrase begins now if. Or if you have a New American Standard, it begins but if. And this is super important. Like there's another transition word in there. There's a connecting word that ties this back to verses 2-4. And it could be translated either one of those ways that I just mentioned, either now or but. And so verse 5 actually begins, now if, or but if, any of you lacks wisdom. And so it's contrasting with what came right before in verse 4, which is interesting because there's another connection between these two verses as well. And you might notice there the word lack. And so verse 4 says, let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. And then verse 5 begins, but if any of you lacks wisdom. And so the flow of thought here from verse 4 to verse 5 is that if you respond to trials the way that James calls you to in verses 2-4, like if you see what they will ultimately produce in you, and so you count it all joy and you let steadfastness have its full effect, over time you will become perfect or mature and you'll become complete, lacking in nothing. But in the meantime, if any of you lacks wisdom, here's what to do. And so the question then is, what is this wisdom that we potentially lack and that James is concerned about us lacking here? So this is the word that makes verse 5 here feel like James is changing topics to talk about something completely different. But the two connections that we just saw make it clear that he's not. So the question is, what's the connection between wisdom and responding to trials with joy and steadfastness? Well, we tend to think of wisdom as the ability to make decisions, like specifically right decisions, especially in difficult situations or circumstances. So like when we're facing a tough choice between two options and we don't really know which way is best, we may ask each other to pray for wisdom, meaning help me know which option I ought to choose. Or we'll ask for counsel advice from someone who's wise, meaning somebody that we can trust to help us figure out what's best. But biblically speaking, and especially from an Old Testament perspective, which is what James would have been shaped by, wisdom is something more than that. And so if you remember, we talked about this when we went through Proverbs a few sermon series ago, if you're around for that. Like biblically speaking, wisdom is not just knowing what's right, it's doing what's right. Like specifically, it's the skill or ability to live well in God's world in light of God's rule. Like it's knowing what's true about God and ourselves and the world that we live in, and then living consistently with those truths. It's living out what we believe. That's what wisdom is. And that's what the whole book of James is ultimately about. But it's also exactly what verses 2 through 4 were about as well, right? Like the whole point of verses 2 through 4 is that we know that because God is sovereign over our lives, that the trials and suffering we face are for our good. They're producing steadfastness in us. They're making us mature and complete, lacking in nothing. So we live out then what we believe. Like we count it all joy and we let steadfastness have its full effect. And when we do, that's wisdom. And so again, remember, the purpose of this book is to encourage believers to remain steadfast in the middle of trials and suffering, to flesh out what that looks like in everyday life. And so for James, then that life of patient endurance in the middle of suffering can be summed up as wisdom. And that wisdom is what we're going to see unpacked all through this book as we go. But specifically here, it's the steadfastness that the testing of our faith produces. It's the maturity that trials ultimately produce in our lives. It's the ability to respond to trials with joy and steadfastness. Like, that's wisdom. So James' point here in verse 5, in light of verses 2 through 4 then, is if any of you lacks the ability to respond to trials with joy and steadfastness like this, here's what to do. Oh, and here's where that little word if, though, can cause confusion if we're not careful. That if at the beginning of verse 5 could come across as if there are some people who don't lack this wisdom and some people who do. And it could come across as if this wisdom is something you should have and you should feel bad and kind of embarrassed and ashamed of yourself if you don't. But that's not the point here at all. It's almost the exact opposite. This isn't something that may occasionally happen to some of us. It's the daily reality for all of us. And James knows that. One commentator explains the wording here like this. He says, here James employs what's called a condition of fact, assuming the truthful reality of the problem. The beginning could be translated, since you of course lack the wisdom you need. So the point here is that James knows and expects that we'll feel our lack of ability to respond to trials the way that he describes in verses 2 through 4. Like, he knows how easy it is to say this, but how hard it is to live it out in the middle of actual suffering. Like, that's exactly what we talked about at the beginning. James is answering the question, how in the world do you respond to trials like that? Because he knows that that's what all of us feel when we read those verses, if we're being honest. And here's the thing, though. Even as we go through trials and they produce steadfastness in us and they cause us to grow in maturity and wisdom, we're not going to feel our lack of wisdom any less. In fact, we're going to feel it more. Like, maturity isn't needing God less. Wisdom isn't needing God less. It's seeing our need for God more. And so the reality is, even the wisest of us are only beginning to see just how deep our need for God goes. We need him infinitely more than we'll ever know. So if you read this verse and you think you're one of those people that this doesn't apply to, you might not be as wise as you think you are. And as you grow in wisdom, you'll actually feel your need for this verse more than you do right now. Especially in times of suffering. Like, it's right and healthy to see and feel our lack of wisdom in those moments in particular. Like, to see and feel our need for help to live out what we believe. Ultimately, that's the point here. Like, that's the first part of the answer to how we respond to trials with joy and steadfastness. It's to recognize our need for wisdom, to admit that we lack the ability to see trials the way James describes in verses 2 to 4, and to respond to trials with joy and steadfastness. This is so huge, because if you respond to verses 2 through 4 by trying to produce that kind of response in your own strength, and you just hide your pain and hide your tears and put on a fake smile and grit your teeth and endure, Like if you just convince yourself you've got this and you don't need to recognize your lack of wisdom, like you'll just shrug your shoulders then at the answer that James gives in the rest of verse 5. Oh, but if you feel how difficult verses 2 through 4 are to do, and you recognize your need for wisdom to respond to trials with joy and steadfastness, like if you respond to the first part of verse 5 with, that's me, that's me, that's who you're talking to, then James has an answer for you. And that's what we're going to see in the rest of verse 5. How to respond to trials with joy and steadfastness. First, recognize your need for wisdom. Second, ask God for the wisdom that you need. Ask God for the wisdom that you need. Look at the rest of verse 5 here. It says, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. Oh, this is such a sweet verse. The reality is we all lack wisdom. We lack the ability to count it all joy and let steadfastness have its full effect in trials. But James says, if that's you, all you have to do is ask God. Like, just ask him. But notice what this is saying here. First, we need to pay attention to what it's saying to ask God for. Like, when we're in the middle of trials and suffering, our temptation and tendency is to ask God for deliverance from our trials and suffering. Like, take it away. Get us out of this as quickly as possible. Or if we do ask for wisdom, we're probably thinking in terms like we talked about a minute ago, like answers to our trial and suffering. Like, help us know what to do. Help us figure this out so that we can get it over with. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing to pray for. So don't feel bad for praying for that. Don't stop praying for that. But James says that there's something else that we should be praying for in light of what trials are ultimately producing in us and doing for us. And it's this. We should be praying for wisdom, for the ability to respond to trials with joy and steadfastness, like we just talked about, for the ability to believe in the middle of trials and suffering that this is doing something good in us and that this is for our ultimate good and that God would help us live like that's true, that he would help us respond not with grumbling and complaining, but with rejoicing, even in the middle of tears, and that he would help us not panic, but patiently endure, and that through that patient endurance, he would mature us and make us more like Jesus. Like, that's ultimately what we need in the middle of trials and suffering. So that's what we should be asking for. And so just think about that for a second. Like, is that what you tend to pray for yourself in your own trials and suffering? Is that what we tend to pray for each other when we're facing trials and suffering? Again, it's not wrong to plead with the Lord to take away suffering. Paul did that, 2 Corinthians 12. But are we okay if God's answer to that prayer for us is like it was to Paul? No, not going to do that. But my grace is sufficient for you. It'll be better for you if I don't take this away right now. Are we going to be okay? Like, the only way that we can respond with joy in that situation, like Paul did in 2 Corinthians 12, is to ask God for wisdom to respond to trials with joy and steadfastness. So that's what we're supposed to ask for. That's the point here. That's what he's talking about. That's what we ask for. Notice, too, though, that this isn't just a one-time thing. The way that this is worded is similar to Matthew 7:7. If you're familiar with that verse, Jesus says, ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and it will be opened to you. And so you may have heard in that verse how the ask, seek, and knock there are worded in a way that has the sense of ongoing action. Like, ask and keep on asking. Seek and keep on seeking. Knock and keep on knocking. And that's the same way James 1:5 here is worded. Like, he may very well have Matthew 7:7 in mind here. Like, the point is that our need for wisdom is ongoing, so our asking should be ongoing. Like, as we grow in wisdom, again, we're just going to see our need for it even more. So we don't just ask God once. Like, we ask and we keep on asking. If anything, the frequency of this prayer just continues to increase throughout our lives. Oh, but then look at the motivation that James gives us to ask God for the wisdom that we need. Like, he roots this encouragement to ask God in the character of God and in the promise of God. You can see that next there on your handout. First, the character of God gives us confidence to ask him for wisdom. The character of God gives us confidence to ask him for wisdom. Look how James describes God here. First, he says that he is God who gives. Like, God is a giving God. Like, is that how you think of him? Like, we can so easily have this picture of God in our minds that he's tight-fisted, that we have to beg and plead with him to get anything from him, practically, like, pry things out of his hands. But the opposite is true. Like, he's a giving God. He delights to give. Like, from the beginning, he's been giving. Like, the only reason we exist is because he created and gave us life and breath and everything. And even in spite of our rebellion and sin, he continues to give, even the most precious gift that we can possibly imagine. Romans 8:32 says, "He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also with him graciously give us all things?" Like, God is not holding out on us or holding back from us. Like, that's the picture of God that the serpent wanted Eve to have in the garden. But God gives. Like, we see the evidence around us every moment of every day. And we see the ultimate evidence in Jesus. So we can have confidence to ask God for wisdom because he's a God who gives. Oh, not only that, he's a God who gives generously. And so the word translated generously here, it can mean that. That's very true. We sort of just talked about that. Like, God lavishes good things on us. We're going to see this a little later in James 1, verse 17. It says, "Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there's no variation or shadow due to change." Now, if you keep going in Matthew 7 that we read just a minute ago, Jesus says, "Which one of you, if his son asks him for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for fish, we'll give him a serpent. If you then, who are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father who is in heaven give good things to those who ask him?" Like, God is not stingy in his giving. He's a good father who delights in giving good things to his children. Like, as much delight as I take in giving my kids what they ask for and even going above and beyond what they ask for, God is a far better father than any human father and far more generous than we will ever be. So it's 100% true that God is generous. But the word here could actually be translated another way that makes more sense within the context of James here. The other way that it could be translated is as singly or single-mindedly. And the meaning there would be that God gives without reservation. He gives without second thoughts. He's not wavering back and forth on his giving. Like, God delights to give us what we need. He has no hesitation in doing so. Like, he's completely focused. He's single-minded in giving us what we need when we ask him for what we need. And so keep that in mind, because we're going to see someone who's the opposite of that here in just a minute in verse 8. But the point in all this is that we can have confidence that God will give us what we need because he's a God who gives generously or single-mindedly. Next, James says that he gives generously to all. Gives to all. So we're gonna see someone in a minute who sounds like an exception to this, but we'll get to that in a minute. For now, the point is that God doesn't just give generously to some, as if you might be one of the ones that he won't give generously to. God doesn't only give generously to the super spiritual. Like, this isn't a frequent flyer program where you have to be platinum elite level to get access to God's generous giving. Like, the point is, like, this is talking about you. That's what you're supposed to hear in this. He's talking about you. He will generously give to you. Like, that should give you confidence to ask him. And finally, James says that he gives generously to all without reproach. Oh, this is so good. This means a couple of things. At first, it means that God doesn't resent you for your need for wisdom. He doesn't resent your need for wisdom. He doesn't see you coming to him again asking for wisdom and roll his eyes, shake his head. Oh, great. Here comes that high maintenance person again, always needing my help, always asking for wisdom. Like, when are they going to get it together and stop bugging me all the time? No. Like, God's not irritated to have you ask for wisdom again and again. Like, he doesn't resent your need for wisdom. It also means he doesn't mock or belittle or make fun of your need for wisdom. Like, he's not laughing at you for asking him for wisdom again and again. He's not pointing you out and making jokes about how pathetic you are because you don't have this figured out yet. Like, he's not putting you down behind your back. Oh, like, we've all had people do that to us before when we've asked for help. It makes it really hard to ask them for help again, if we ever ask them for help again. But the good news is God's not like that. He gives without reproach. Like, you don't have to be afraid to ask him for what you need. He's not going to resent you or mock you. Again, he's a good father who delights to give good things to his children. Like, oh, how much confidence should all of that give us to ask God for the wisdom we need? Like, he gives generously or single-mindedly to all without reproach. So ask him. Oh, but James doesn't stop there. He grounds our asking in the character of God, but he also grounds it in the promise of God. That's what we see next. The promise of God gives us confidence to ask him for wisdom as well. Look at the very end of verse 5. And it will be given to him. Like, that's a promise. Again, it seems like James has Matthew 7:7 in mind here. Ask, and it will be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and it will be open to you. For everyone who asks receives, and the one who seeks finds, and to the one who knocks, it will be opened. And there are about a dozen other verses in the New Testament alone that say something similar. But God promises over and over again that if we ask, he will give us what we ask for. Now, James is going to talk a couple of times later in this letter about reasons that God does not give us what we ask for. And so this is not a blanket, unconditional promise. But again, James is talking about asking God for something specific here, for wisdom, for the ability to respond to trials and suffering with joy and steadfastness. And that's a prayer that we can have confidence that God will answer because it's something he wants to produce in us already. So the promise that it will be given to us gives us confidence to ask him for wisdom. Here's the thing, though. God promises wisdom, not answers. Job asked God for answers for his trials and suffering. And God finally came and responded to him, but he didn't give him answers. He gave him wisdom. And then Job let go of his need for answers. And ultimately, this point right here is the answer to the question of how to respond to trials with joy and steadfastness, like verses 2 to 4 call us to. The answer is to ask God for wisdom, to produce that type of joy and steadfastness in us so that that's what comes out when we meet with trials of various kinds. Like, we need to see our need for wisdom, but then that drives us to cry out to God for the wisdom that we need. So if you're walking through a season of trial or suffering right now, like, are you doing this? Are you asking God for wisdom? Are you asking him to produce joy and steadfastness in you because you lack it in and of yourself? Oh, he gives generously to all without reproach, and he will give it to you. Even if you're not in the middle of a season of trial or suffering right now, ask him for wisdom now so that you're prepared for when that season comes and so that you're already in the habit of seeing your need and asking him for what you ultimately need in that moment. But here's the thing. Like, there's a difference between receiving wisdom and feeling wise. Like, remember, the more we grow in wisdom, the more we'll see how much more we need. So it can often feel like we're asking God for wisdom, but we don't feel any wiser. We still struggle to count it all joy and let steadfastness have its full effect. Well, that's where faith comes in, which is the third part of the answer to how to respond to trials with joy and steadfastness. Look with me at verses 6 to 8. we'll see that we also need this third thing. We need to trust God to give us the wisdom that we need. We need to trust God to give us the wisdom that we need. Now, these verses can be a little tricky here. It's easy to misunderstand what James is saying here. James' point, though, is actually pretty straightforward. And so let's read these verses, and we'll talk about what's going on here. Hopefully, you'll be able to see what he's saying. So look with me at verse 6. It says, "But let him ask in faith, with no doubting. For the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea that's driven and tossed by the wind. For that person must not suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. He's a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways." So the first thing here is to not disconnect verses 6 through 8 from verse 5. Verse 6 here is connecting back to the middle of verse 5, if you notice. The flow of thought here is, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, but let him ask in faith. That's the flow of what James is saying here. And so the point here is that we recognize our need for wisdom, so then we ask God for the wisdom we need, but then James gives us a condition or even a warning here when it comes to how we ask. He says that we're to ask in faith with no doubting. So what does that mean? Like, is James saying that if you ever have any doubts, God won't answer your prayers? Like, is he saying that if you ever have any spiritual questions, like if you're ever wrestling with something in the Bible, if you ever have any moments or even seasons of struggling with assurance as a Christian, like you're just out of luck when it comes to asking God then? Like, there are some that would say that that's what this is talking about. That in order for God to answer your prayer, you have to really, really believe. And you have to have enough faith. And that if your prayers don't get answered, it's because you didn't have enough faith. You didn't believe enough. But that's not what James is saying here. And we know that for one reason, because if God answering our prayers was based on us having enough faith and never having any doubts, like our prayers would never be getting answered. And so what is James talking about here? Thankfully, James explains what he means here in the rest of these verses. And so let's unpack that a little bit. First, the word doubt here, the word doubt itself, it may not be the best way to translate the word that James uses here. The word that he uses has the idea of wavering between two things, like wavering between two options. And that's exactly then the picture that James paints in the rest of this section. So he's going to give us two illustrations, two pictures of what he's talking about here. One at the end of verse 6, and then one in verse 8. And so first, in verse 6, he says that the one who doubts, or the one who wavers, is like a wave of the sea that's driven and tossed by the wind. So you can picture what that looks like, right? Like this wind here is probably more than just a gentle breeze, though even that causes water to move. But more likely, he's wanting us to picture a storm, which is a good illustration of a trial or suffering. James, he grew up near the Sea of Galilee, so he would have known what a storm-tossed sea looks like. And so his point here in verse 6 is that the person who doubts or wavers, when a trial or suffering comes, they're just like a wave of the sea in a storm. Up and down, back and forth, driven and tossed, never at rest, never stable. That's the first picture that we see. Then he gives us another illustration in verse 8. He says that this person, this waverer, is a double-minded man. And so just try to picture what that might look like. Like this person has two minds pulling in different directions here. Like, that's the point here. Like the word double-minded literally means two-souled. Like, it's a word that's going to come up one other place in James as well, though, in James chapter 4. And there, James describes someone who's trying to be friends with both God and the world at the same time. And then he tells them to cleanse their hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. And so this double-minded person then is someone with divided loyalties. Like, they're wavering back and forth between trusting God and trusting something else. Like in chapter 4, specifically the world, but maybe even more within the overall flow of James and what he's picturing here is more the idea of like trusting in themselves. I think that's ultimately what James has in mind here, is someone who lives most of their life as if they're in control and as if they can handle things on their own. And they're pursuing the things of the world for their own benefit and enjoyment. But then a trial comes along and things get hard, and then they run to God and ask for his help. Does that sound familiar at all? Like, that's the kind of person that James is talking about here. And the end result here is the same as the storm-tossed wave. Like, the double-minded person is unstable in all their ways, always up and down, always back and forth, never at rest, never stable. And so that's the pictures. You kind of get the idea of what's going on here? Right in the middle of this, then, right in the middle of these two illustrations, James tells us what that kind of person can expect to get from God when they ask him for help in their trial. Verse 7, that person, the one who wavers between trusting in themselves and trusting in God, must not suppose that he'll receive anything from the Lord. Like, that's pretty sobering. Like, the point here is, if you are characterized by wavering back and forth between trusting in God and trusting in yourself, like if you live a self-sufficient life most of the time and only turn to God when things get hard, you really shouldn't expect much from God. You shouldn't expect him to answer your prayer for wisdom. You should expect to end up driven and tossed by the trials that come your way. Like, you should expect to feel constantly unstable, which is the exact opposite of the steadfastness that trials are intended to produce in us, right? And you can imagine that it's pretty hard to count it all joy when you're being driven and tossed all the time. Like, that's what doubting is here. And so if that's what doubting is, it's easier than to understand what James means by asking in faith. So in contrast with double-minded, wavering back and forth between trust in self and trust in God, faith then is single-minded trust in God. It's what God calls his people to in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4, the Shema. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. And so God is one, so we are to love him single-mindedly, with all our heart, with all our soul, with all our might. Like, no double-mindedness, no wavering. And again, this connects us back to the character of God in verse 5 that we mentioned before. We are to ask with single-minded trust in the God who gives single-mindedly. Like, that's what faith means here. And it's not that we have perfect faith. It's that we're like the father asking Jesus to heal his son in Mark 9. You remember that story? Like, this father brings his son to Jesus and says, help him if you can. And Jesus is like, if you can? All things are possible to him who believes. And you remember how the father responds? He says, I believe. Help my unbelief. And Jesus answers his prayer and heals his son. That's all the faith that it takes. You don't have to be perfect faith. Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. Or it's like Abraham. We just spent a lot of time studying his life last year. Like, was his faith always perfect? No, far from it. Like, he questioned God. He took matters into his own hands. He laughed at God's promise. But Romans 4, verse 20 and 21 says this of Abraham. It says, no unbelief made him waver concerning the promise of God. But he grew strong in his faith as he gave glory to God, fully convinced that God was able to do what he had promised. That's what faith looks like. It's trusting the character of God and the promise of God and continuing to ask God for wisdom to respond to trials with joy and steadfastness. Not perfect, but at the end of the day, your hope and your trust is in him alone, not in yourself, not in anyone or anything else. And again, this trust is necessary here because of the difference between receiving wisdom and feeling wise. Like, we recognize our need for wisdom, so we ask God, and then we trust that God will give us the wisdom we need, whether or not we feel any more wise in the moment then. And that is the testing of our faith that produces steadfastness that James talked about in verse 3. Like, as we continue to trust in that way, in the middle of our trials, God grows, God produces steadfastness in us. We'll be less and less driven and tossed by the winds of suffering. We'll be more and more stable. We'll be more and more able to count it all joy when we face trials of various kinds, because we know, not just intellectually or theoretically, but because we have seen and we have experienced God answering our prayers for wisdom. And we feel the growth and steadfastness happening, even if we don't feel any wiser in the moment. Like, that's how to respond to trials with joy and steadfastness. Number one, recognize your need for wisdom. See that on your own, in your own strength, you won't be able to see trials the way that James talks about in verses 2-4. Like, you need God's help to see the good that they're producing in you and to respond with joy and steadfastness, especially when you're in the middle of suffering. James knows that. God knows that. Like, that's to be expected. You lack wisdom. You lack the ability to do that. You need his help. And so recognize your need for wisdom and let that cause you to cry out to God and ask him for the wisdom that you need. Like, ask him to help you see the good that trials and suffering are producing in you, or at least to trust that that's true, even if you can't see it. Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. Like, ask him to help you count it all joy because of what trials and suffering are producing in you. Ask him to help you let steadfastness have its full effect. And then trust him to give you the wisdom that you need. Like, trust his character. Trust that he is the God who gives generously to all without reproach. Like, trust his promise that if you ask for wisdom to respond to trials with joy and steadfastness, he will give it to you. And then keep doing this over and over and over and over, trusting that whether you feel it or not, God is answering your prayer for wisdom, and he's producing steadfastness in you more and more. And let knowing that then cause you to count whatever trials or suffering you face as all joy. Let's pray. Father, thank you for these verses here. Thank you that you don't leave us with just verses 2-4. They're sweet. Verses 2-4 are sweet to remind us and to help us to see what trials are producing in us, and call us to live like that's true by counting it all joy and letting it have its full effect. Lord, we need those verses, but we also feel our need because we know we don't know how to do that, especially in the middle of suffering. In so many ways, in the middle of suffering, that's the last thing that we want to hear, the last thing that we can even begin to wrap our mind around. And so you don't leave us there, Father. You give us these instructions for how to respond that way in the middle of trials. And you don't give us some big, long, complicated checklist that we have to do. It's as easy as asking you. And so, Father, I pray that you would just give us confidence in you, not in ourselves. Lord, I pray that we would see our need for wisdom, see our lack of wisdom, that when we hear those words at the beginning of verse 5, that we would recognize ourselves in it, that that's me. I lack wisdom. I don't know how to do that. I don't have the ability to respond to trials with joy and steadfastness like verses 2-4 talk about. I need help. And let that lack, that recognition of our need, cause us to cry out to you for help. Father, thank you that you are a God who gives generously to all without reproach. Lord, I pray that reminder of your character would give us confidence to ask you for the wisdom that we need. And Father, thank you that you promise to give us wisdom if we ask you. And let that give us confidence to ask you. But Lord, help us to ask in faith with no doubting. Lord, I pray that we would not waver back and forth, that we would not live most of our lives as if we've got everything under control, live self-sufficient lives most of the time, and then when things get hard, run to you for help and expect to receive anything from you. Lord, guard us against that way of living. Father, produce in us more and more a single-minded faith in you that despairs of any ability in ourselves to live like this and throws ourselves completely on you and trusts you to do in us what only you can do. And Father, through that test of faith then, through believing you, even when it doesn't feel like that's possible to do, and continuing to walk in dependence and obedience in those moments, Lord, produce the steadfastness in us that James 2 through 4 talks about. Produce that steadfastness in us and let it have its full effect, Father, so that we be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. And let the knowledge of that, let knowing that that's happening in us, cause us to count it all joy. Lord, thank you that you help us to that end. Pray that we would throw ourselves on you and on your help today. And the promises and in the character that we've seen in these verses, give us confidence to do that. We ask all this in Jesus' name. Amen.